This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Reese Witherspoon, started acting as a child and became famous in her 20s after starring in films like Election and Legally Blonde. But when she reached her mid-30s, it was hard to find good roles for women her age. So she decided to address the problem by starting her own production company with the mission of finding books with complex women characters and adapting those books into films. She adapted Gillian Flynn's best-selling crime novel, Gone Girl. She didn't act in that one, but she starred in the next film she produced, an adaptation of Cheryl Strayed's memoir, Wild. Witherspoon executive produces and stars in Big Little Lies, adapted from Leanne Moriarty's novel. Now Witherspoon is an executive producer and star of the new series, The Morning Show, which deals with sexual harassment and assault and their aftermath in the world of news and entertainment. It's one of the first offerings on Apple's new streaming service, Apple TV+. The series is about a popular network morning TV show that's shaken up when its male anchor, played by Steve Carell, is fired after he's accused of sexual misconduct. His co-host, Alex, played by Jennifer Aniston, still in shock about the news, learns that the network had been planning on replacing her in the hopes of boosting their sagging ratings. To save her job, she makes a bold move. At an awards ceremony, she announces that her co-anchor's replacement will be Bradley Jackson, played by Reese Witherspoon. Bradley is a local reporter from a network affiliate who became nationally known after a video went viral showing her confronting a demonstrator at a coal mine protest in West Virginia. Alex didn't consult with or get permission from anyone at the network before announcing her new co-anchor would be Bradley. She didn't even tell Bradley, who was stunned and kind of angry. So here's the two of them, after the announcement, standing in the morning show's studio.
Want to take a seat?
Is that an invitation or a command?
You sound a little pissed off.
I don't like surprises.
Oh, come on, that was a pretty good surprise.
No, you don't get to make this about me. You dropped a bomb, and I don't know why. Maybe you're trying to blow up your life. Maybe you're angry, which I get. But you don't have the right to f*** with me.
How? By offering you the most coveted anchor job in the world?
I don't want your job.
Oh, honey, f***.
You are so cocky. You just think I'm gonna do this?
I know you're going to do this.
I don't have a contract.
Well, great. I just put you in a great spot to negotiate. This job is yours. I'm welcoming you with open arms. I'm giving you the biggest news platform you could ever have. If you're a true journalist, you don't say no to this.
I'm not sure this is considered true journalism.
And how many current or former presidents have you interviewed?
This job requires a certain kind of positivity. I'm not a perky person.
I don't care. I don't want us to be the same. I'm not looking to groom my replacement. I want a partner.
Do you? Or do you want somebody who's beholden to you? Somebody who's grateful that you plucked them from obscurity? Because if that's what you're hoping for, I will give you serious buyer's remorse.
Reese Witherspoon, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on the new series.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm such a huge fan.
Oh, back at you. this show, The Morning Show, was already in the works when the Matt Lauer story broke and the Charlie Rose story broke. What was your reaction about what it would mean for the show, particularly for the Matt Lauer story's meaning for the show? Because that's the story that's most closely shadowed.
You know, I think it's interesting because I think people pull that parallel, but it actually is an amalgam of a lot of different characters. You have to remember we have Bill O'Reilly. There's the things that happened at CBS at a very high corporate level, also at 60 Minutes. And so really we were inundated with this new information. We were working based off of Brian Stelter's book, Top of the Morning, which definitely delved into sexism and ageism in modern broadcast media. But what emerged was all these assault allegations and hostile work environment and harassment claims. And we felt it would have been remiss if we didn't address them in our show. And so the showrunner, Carrie Aaron, to her credit, I think, decided to delve in scene one, episode one. And I think, you know, sometimes the world is so crazy. TV shows and movies are a great way to try and understand where we're at.
So we talked a little bit about what it would mean for the show when the sexual assault and sexual harassment stories and broadcasting broke. What was your personal reaction to that and to Harvey Weinstein and to Ronan Farrow's book, Catch and Kill, like from personal experience and from the experience of other women you knew, that sexual harassment and assault was not uncommon in the entertainment industry. But when all these stories started breaking...
I'm sorry, can I interrupt you?
Yeah.
I didn't know assault was happening with such frequency and regularity.
Tell me.
It's important to say that I didn't have any idea what other people's experiences were. I'd only had my own experiences, and I had definitely dealt with harassment, and I had dealt with that privately and in my own way with my family when I was young, when I was really young and starting in the business. I didn't have any understanding of the widespread abuse that women were experiencing, and not just women, many people were experiencing. And it really took that moment in time for all of us to start talking, because you have to remember, as an actress for hire, I was the only woman on a set. I would say the majority of my 30-year career, I've been the only woman in a cast or one of a handful of women in a crew or a cast. So when all of that started happening, women started to gather and really start talking to each other and sharing stories. And I have to say, I was blown away. I did not know the kind of experiences that people were having. And I was in shock. I think a lot of us were in shock.
So you really have managed to get a lot of power in the entertainment industry, not through anybody kind of anointing you with it, but through just like deciding you're going to get some power and produce things that you think should be produced with more roles for women and more women behind the scenes. And Big Little Lies, a series that you adapted from the novel and co-starred in, was such a big success, but that's something that you willfully did. Do you know what I mean? Like you decided this was going to be what you needed to do to make your career more interesting and to improve opportunities for women in Hollywood. What gave you the idea that that was something you wanted to do and could do? Because that's different from acting.
Mm-hmm. Well, about 2010. About a third of our business, the revenue of our business, just dropped out with the DVD business kind of going away. So when you went to the studios, they had to reduce production and development by 30%. And the first things to go are the things that have the smallest margins, which is kind of the $30 to $40 million movie, which is where women live, you know. Comedies, it's where I emerged from Legally Blonde to Sweet Home Alabama. You know, that was kind of the budget level of films that I was working on. And all of a sudden, you just felt like, I went to every single studio and I said, what are you developing for women? And with the exclusion of one studio, everybody said nothing. Nothing with a female lead. And one person said to me, one studio head said, well, we already have one movie starring a woman this year. We can't have two. And I was furious. I just went home and I was mad, and I called my mother and I was upset, and I called my friends, and I, can you believe this? They're not developing anything for women, to star women. And my husband said to me, you know, you read more than anybody I know, honey. Why don't you option some books and turn them into movies? And I don't think I realized how much I read. I thought everybody read as much as I read. But he pointed out to me, no, you really go through material quickly, and you've been in the business long enough to know what's going to be made and what's not going to be made, which creates a great filter, you know? So I decided to self-fund a company and started in a little office that my friend let me rent from her, and started with two people. And that's our first two projects were Gone Girl and Wild. And we read them both in galleys and got the rights to both of them and got them made, which was incredible. So that sort of started the ball rolling. And that made me feel like, oh my God. And then also got some, we got Oscar nominations for Laura Dern and Rosamund Pike that year. And I thought, well, this isn't just about me trying to create parts for myself. I wanna create better parts for women. I wanna have more female authors get their stories told. I know what to do. I know every producer in Hollywood, and I know how to get a movie from book to script to screen, and I know how to market it. So I'm just betting on myself, I guess, you know, taking the risk and betting on myself.
You know, one of the things you talked about is how characters in the novel and people who you know in real life have had to deal with turning points in their lives where they have to decide, am I at the age where I should try something new? And if I try something new, what is it? You went through a version of that before you decided to become a producer and take matters into your own hands in terms of finding roles and creating roles. And, you know, you've spoken about how in your mid-30s, like, there were just, like, no good roles for women. What was available in those few roles? What were you being offered, or what were you trying to fight for?
I think it's interesting. People always say, after you win the Oscar, did your whole career change? It doesn't. You look around, there wasn't suddenly this huge influx of scripts that are incredibly, there's not a secret safe they're keeping the great scripts in, you know, and they unlock it when you win awards. I was lucky to do a couple of great movies in my 30s, but not a lot. And Wild was a big deal for me because, first of all, I love Cheryl Strayed's writing. Her memoir is beautiful. But it's also a woman versus nature, which I had never really seen on film. And so many women are so deeply connected to nature, yet it's not something we've explored. We've seen every iteration of a man versus a bear versus the Wild West on hiking adventures. But I haven't seen a lot of a woman alone on film as well. And what is that singular journey for a woman to find herself alone in the wilderness?
And she takes that hike because, and this is based on a memoir, she takes that hike because her mother died. She's grieving, and she's been numbing herself with heroin, and also by having a lot of sex with men who are not her husband. Therefore, her marriage breaks up. And I want to play a scene where your character is talking to a therapist, and the therapist is trying to help her, like, face what the real problem is, and she's resisting it. The therapist is played by Randy Shulman. And as this clip starts, your character's talking about how much she misses her mother, her late mother.
She was the love of my life. There's something else to say about it. I thought there'd be couches and Kleenex and
That's $50 an hour therapy. This is $10 an hour therapy. So why do you think you were destroyed by your mother's death?
Is that your job? To tell the bereaved that they're grieving too much?
People grieve in all sorts of different ways. I'm asking you about yours.
Is mine so bad?
You're using heroin, and you're having sex with anyone who asks. I'm not sure that these things are making you happy.
Well, that's where you're wrong, because when I'm doing them, I feel good and happy. And when I'm not, I feel like I want to die.
You sleep with your husband, too?
No, I'm sort of like a guy about sex. I just prefer to be detached.
You think that's what guys are like?
You are here. I see that poster everywhere, and I hate it. Why would you ever want to teach a child they don't matter?
Did you feel as though you mattered?
I know I mattered.
So who detached from you?
Right. You know what? It's not going to work. This is not about talking.
That's Reese Witherspoon in a scene from Wild. You know, you said you wanted to make a movie where it was woman in nature, or woman against nature, woman alone in nature, the kind of film you don't typically see with a woman as the lead. I mean, can you imagine taking a 1,000-mile hike to help you get sober and get your head straight?
No.
No, I can't.
No. I hike for a couple hours and I'm exhausted.
I take a walk around the block. I mean.
But that's why Cheryl's story is so singular and so moving. It's how she went from feeling so broken and self-consumed to feeling like she was able to save her own life. And what I really love about the movie is that you get to the end and she walks across the bridge and she ends her hike with this beautiful monologue that she's by herself in the world. She has no partner. She has no money. She has no job. The love of her life, her mother, is gone, but she's happy. She's really happy. And I think that's so profound. And I had such an interesting experience working on the show where I'm so verbal. I talk so much in movies that I didn't have anything to say. I couldn't rely on my old tricks in that movie, which were telling jokes and ad-libbing. I had nobody to talk to. I was just walking. And it was really a challenge.
So you won an Oscar for playing June Carter Cash in the 2005 film Walk the Line. She is country music royalty. She was from the Carter family, the most famous family in country music, and she married Johnny Cash. And so you had to sing in that role. Had you sung professionally before?
Well, when I was a little girl, I wanted to be a country music singer. So I trained for probably 5-6 years with vocal coaches. I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, so I grew up with a lot of country music singers and their kids, and it was just immersed every weekend.
So you grew up with country music, not on the radio, but in real life?
No, in real life, yeah.
Well, how'd you know?
Well, like Minnie Pearl's daughter went to my school, Emmy Lou Harris's kids.
You're kidding.
And Amy Grant went to my high school, and and I actually knew Johnny Cash's granddaughter when I was really little, but it was just part of, you know, Nashville. It was just normal. We all kind of were immersed in the culture of country music.
So what did you sing?
What did I sing when I was little?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, I wanted to be just like Dolly Parton when I was little. I wanted to write and I wanted to sing my own songs. And I took piano lessons, and I took singing lessons. And then when I was about 13, I went and I started studying Broadway at camps in New York, in upstate New York. And they would have all these experts come in. And one of the experts said, they had an acting expert, a dance expert, and singing expert. And the singing coach said, you really should not put a lot of energy into your singing career.
Oh, great. Uh-huh.
So I got intimidated and they said, but your acting is great and you should really pursue that. So that's when I kind of tacked left when I was 13 and started just working on acting and concentrating. And so when this opportunity came up to play June Carter, I was terrified and I'd been told I wasn't any good. So I worked for 5 months with a coach, Roger Love, and with the producer, T-Bone Burnett, to cut the tracks before we ever walked on set. We recorded all the music so that we could blend tracks, live tracks, and recorded tracks together. But then we had to actually go and shoot the movie, and I had to sing in front of audiences of hundreds of people with Joaquin Phoenix on stage with a band. And it was terrifying. It was terrifying, but thrilling.
So I want to play you singing a duet with Joaquin Phoenix from Walk the Line.
Oh, goodness. And
this is the song Time's a-Wasting. And just to set it up a little bit, in the story, you and your first husband have broken up, and you and Johnny Cash have been kind of drawn to each other. And he calls you out on stage when you're both performing separately. You've been performing separately, but he calls you out on stage and kind of makes you sing a duet with him. And the duet he makes you sing is a song that you had recorded with your husband. And you do not want to sing that song with Johnny Cash. But as we'll hear, he kind of forces you to do it. And here's what it sounds like.
Hi, folks. How y'all doing again? I hope y'all don't mind my bare feet. So what are we going to sing, Johnny? You got me out here. Is that where your plan ends?
Well, I always liked that song of yours, Time's a-Wasting. Let's do that one.
Oh, come on. I don't know about that. How about your hit song, Big River? That's a good song.
Well,
Big River ain't a duet.
Let's do Time's a Wasting.
John, I am not going to sing that song. It's inappropriate. I recorded it with my ex-husband. I'm not going to sing it.
Well, there's no better way to put it behind you.
I'm not going to do it.
You just sing.
Oh, I've got arms.
And I've got arms.
Let's get together and use those arms.
My guest Reese Witherspoon and Joaquin Phoenix from the movie Walk the Line as June Carter and Johnny Cash. I think you sound great on that.
Thanks. You worked really hard on it.
So what was it like for you when the, I guess the person at the acting and music camp told you, like, well, you give up on singing. Like, you're good at acting, but give up on the singing part. It's hard to hear criticism, but when somebody says, like, don't even bother, that must really be hard to overcome. You had to be tough to do that.
Yeah, well, actors are tough. We hear more no's than yeses a lot, you know? So the early parts of my career were about weathering rejection. I would cry sometimes.
Do you still love acting?
I love it. It's my number one passion. Thank you for asking me that, because sometimes people... you know, I talk a lot about producing and a book club, but I, every day I'm on set, feels like such an enormous privilege to be a storyteller in this world. And I started as a little girl as a storyteller, and I will be a storyteller till the day I die. I love it. It's my favorite thing to do at dinner parties, too, so invite me over, Terry.
What, you act at dinner parties?
No, I love to tell stories.
Oh, okay.
I just tell stories. No, I'm not acting. Well, am I acting? I don't know. I just love spinning a story. It's what I was born to do. I love it.
Great. Okay. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much. Good luck with the morning show and with all your many projects.
Thank you so much for having me.
Reese Witherspoon is an executive producer and star of the new series The Morning Show on Apple's new streaming service, Apple TV+. Over the past 2 years, the rapper known as DaBaby has become one of the most popular artists in hip-hop. Known for his high-speed rapping and wide grin, DaBaby has become a frequent guest on other rap stars' songs. His own videos have parodied the exaggerated machismo of other male rappers. His new album, his second in 2019, is called Kirk. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review.
Straight off the rip, you know I don't wait for the drop. The rip. I go out to eat with my kids and my mama, you know I ain't dating no countless hoes. Believe what you see. I can't name a rapper that's out here and breathing, it's f***ing with me. I'm taking they hoe, forces of D's pants and a T. They like how, that don't even match. Okay, huh, take my phone, baby. Let's go.
Few rappers in 2019 have been as entertaining to listen to as DaBaby, whose new album Kirk is one of the year's best hip-hop collections. Born Jonathan Kirk, DaBaby is from Charlotte, North Carolina, and at the age of 27, he's prolific. Kirk is actually his second album this year. The first, released in April and called Baby on Baby, yielded this big hit single called Shug, a little ditty that bounces with energy as DaBaby raps about his success as a businessman.
Pull you a fool for this one.
Oh Lord, Jesse made another one.
Huh? Packing the mail, it's gone. She like I smell cologne. Yeah. I just signed a deal, I'm on. Yeah, yeah. I go where I want, good, good. Play if you want, it's do it. I'm a young CEO, sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the video for Shug, Baby plays a mailman doing a ridiculously bad job of delivering the mail. He displays a flair for a slapstick comedy, in keeping with the sense of humor that first got him some mainstream attention. In 2017, he showed up at that year's South by Southwest Music Festival, roaming the grounds, wearing only an adult diaper. He had just recently, and I would say wisely, changed his stage name, which had been Baby Jesus. The newly christened DaBaby soon proved himself irresistible. His rapid word flow and springy rhythms attracted attention, and soon he was being invited to perform guest verses on other rappers' records, including those of Chance the Rapper, Lizzo, and Megan Thee Stallion. Numerous star rappers returned the favor on this album, chiming in on various tracks. Listen to the way DaBaby sets up a guest verse for Chance the Rapper on the track called Gospel.
Right, it sound like some gospel. I lost my daddy the same week that they lost Nipsey. Ain't got no love left in my heart, my shit be empty. I'm ready to fire on all my options, let it tempt me. And the day I die, I better drown going out in history.
I ain't dull, oh, I've been starting. No hope, it's a no-go, I don't want
and
you.
And everybody wondering why he come round and don't say nothing.
Cause it be so long, it be so long.
Rapper, yeah. Put yourself in my shoes. Like I abandoned a race, and you ran in my place. Shoes too big, but they use hair strands as a lace, and they break. When it's hot outside, you don't want fans in your face. Well, you might want a fan in your face when your man got a heat in the hand and the waist. Burn.
While most of DaBaby's videos emphasize his wide smile, there are undercurrents of seriousness in his music. At various points here, he talks about how hard he's worked to be able to display that smile. And the first cut on Kirk, called Intro, memorializes his late father, whom he says died just as he was becoming popular.
Thinking about my grandmama and I got the number one record, they acknowledge the jit. They going crazy when they play it, head bobbing and and I'm just someone fool. Thinking about my father and they found him dead a couple days before I started to the same day. I flew back to the city from Miami. I was out there with the fam just looking at my door. Thinking to myself like, damn, my baby looks just like my dad. Same time I got the news, my was number one, that's that that was confusing a little bit. You know I flew in with the stick. Okay, like let me know what's up before I lose it in this. And everybody trying to talk, I ain't trying to talk, I'm trying to click. I'm trying to send somebody with somebody, let me know what's happening. I last them K-R-K Kirk, you know how I rock behind my dad. You know I never gave a f*** about the words, it's about my fan. How the f*** I make it to the top, the same day I lost the n*** they had. I performed on BET and a year ago, couldn't afford a sandwich. I had to move in with TG when I went broke, moving out the cash. You know about smiling every day for all your fans, act like you happy. I spent 100,000 laying my daddy to rest, but I ain't brag. I got some questions, I'ma die about respect if I don't get answers. My mama stood up in their chest, took it like a G when she had cancer. My brother be thinking that we don't love him and let him struggle like we ain't family. Like I won't give up all I got to see you happy. We shot the world.
In the often hyper-masculine context of hip-hop, showing a sense of humor can be interpreted as being weak, but this is a label DaBaby has thus far avoided. To judge from his videos, he's not the tallest fellow, but he's got a heavily muscled frame and a dashing handsomeness that lend conviction to his boasting about romance and sex. The fact that he's not afraid to be goofy also works in his favor. Fans like an occasional good laugh in the midst of other artists' grim raps about hard times. When you combine it with unusual instrumentation decorating a vehement beat, his music can seem irresistible. As he himself says on the track called Bop, he's unorthodox.
I'm unorthodox than a muff. Hey, when you gonna switch the flow? I thought you never asked. They f*** me and ain't about what the f*** they be rapping about what they look scary. But to each his own. If you like it, I love it. No big, no fee. That boy say he get money. Oh, really? How much they just cut you a check for? $1 million. I'm going back to Cali like big. Go back. About to go get a pound just to smoke. I smoke. They told me to come work on my album. I'm trying to go find out the price on the boat. Okay. My little f*** like Megan Thee Stallion. She get her when that's she driving the boat. Drive the boat. All this f*** that they making be born. Let me something to bop while I ride with the pole. Here you go. Okay. I needed some shit with some bop in it. I flew past the whip with that blunt in my mouth. Watch it swerving, that whip had a cop in it. Woo. My bitch got good fly her across the country. I finished the show and I hop in it. I got me a milli, I did it legitly. I'm still with the shit, I'm hot.
Right now, more and more people are discovering the pleasures of DaBaby's Southern-style rapid-fire rapping. The way he begins almost every song with an urgent need to start talking even before the music begins. He blasts through Kirk's 13 tracks in under 35 minutes, being simultaneously concise and chatty. He's a fast talker, but he's not a hustler or a fraud. He's the real thing.
Ken Tucker reviewed DaBaby's new album called Kirk. Coming up, we hear from producer, writer, and director Judd Apatow. He'll talk about the subject of his new book, his mentor, Gary Shandling. This is Fresh Air Weekend. My guest Judd Apatow has given many actors their first big break or given their careers a big boost through the movies and TV shows that he's produced and or directed, like Freaks and Geeks, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Superbad, Anchorman, Bridesmaids, Girls, Trainwreck, The Big Sick, and Crashing. We're going to talk about the comic who gave Apatow his big break and became his mentor and close friend, Gary Shandling. Apatow has edited a new book, built around interviews as well as the photos, jokes, letters, and journals Apatow found in Shandling's home after Shandling's death in 2016. The book is called It's Gary Shandling's Book, and it's a companion to the HBO documentary Apatow made last year titled The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling. At the heart of the film and book are Shandling's journals dating back to 1978. Shandling practiced Zen meditation for decades, and pages of his journals are reminders to himself to remain calm, not get attached to worldly things, let go of his ego, aspirations that came into conflict with his neuroses and his obsessive dedication to his comedy. Shandling became famous as a comic in the 70s when Johnny Carson was still hosting The Tonight Show. After making many guest appearances, Shandling became a frequent guest host when Carson was away. But Shandling's groundbreaking contributions were his two TV shows. It's Gary Shandling's Show foreshadowed reality TV and featured a fictionalized version of Shandling that showed him living his life while being followed by a camera crew. The show is very meta, and so is the theme song, whose lyrics were about being a theme song.
This is the theme to Gary Show. Called me up and asked if I would write his theme song. I'm almost halfway finished. How do you like it so far? How do you like the theme to Gary Show?
Shandling's next TV series, The Larry Sanders Show, was also meta. It was a satire in which he starred as the host of a late-night talk show, kind of like The Tonight Show. Let's start with a clip in which Larry's producer, played by Rip Torn, is asking Larry if he's read the new book about the competition and conflict between late-night hosts.
What do you think of that book I gave you? Did you finish it?
Oh, yeah, I read it on the plane. Man, I can't believe Leno actually hid in the closet so he could hear the whole network meeting.
That's a sickness to be so obsessed with what people are saying about you.
I know, that is a sickness. What did people say about me not being mentioned much in the book?
Everybody in town's talking about it.
Good.
Judd Apatow, welcome back to Fresh Air. This new book and your documentary, the book is a loving tribute to Gary Shandling. It's also about how a comic turns insecurity and emotional suffering into comedy. Gary Shandling practiced Zen meditation as a way to deal with his stress, insecurity, emotional pain. And because of that, because he was so into Zen Buddhism, you assumed he didn't hold on to much in terms of, like, possessions, any sentimentality. So after he died, when you went into his house, you were surprised by all the stuff that you found there pertaining to his life. Tell us a little bit about what you found that you've worked into your documentary about him and now the book.
I went to his house, and, you know, there's the immediate question of what do you do with all his stuff? And I... just as a friend, you know, was willing to help the family deal with it. And as a hoarder, I was interested in it not being lost. Because to me, everything about Gary was valuable and is valuable. He wasn't sentimental. And so, for instance, all of his awards were in a trophy case that he built next to his washer and dryer. It's like his Emmy and his Peabody, they're all in this little trophy case in the most disrespectful place in the house. And that's what Gary felt like. He also didn't have any photos of family anywhere in his house. And I just assumed that he didn't care about any of that stuff and tossed it all. And when I started opening closets and looking in boxes, I realized that he didn't throw everything in the garbage. He threw everything in boxes and just chucked them in closets. So, for instance, his brother died when he was 10 years old, and I'd never seen a photo of his brother, but then I would open a box and there would be 100 pictures of his brother. So I don't know if he had a secret nostalgic or sentimental side, but he did keep everything.
And he kept his journals, which he started in the 1970s. And you write that when you found Gary Shandling's journals, you wondered if it was okay for you to read them, if you'd be either violating his privacy or if you'd find out things about him that would make you like him less. But you decided to read them. Did it change your impression of him?
oddly, it changed my impression of him in the sense that I already admired him and I knew he was a man who struggled, but I was surprised that 30 years of journals mainly contained Gary trying to talk to his positive voice. So they weren't journals from the point of view of someone who was just trying to spew all their toxic stuff. A lot of us write in journals like that. We just want to get the bad voice out of our head. And that's not what Gary's journals were like. They were a voice talking to the panicked, anxious voice. So most of the journals were reminders to try to get out of ego, to try to be more kind and loving, to let go. And it's 30 years of reminders about the type of person that he wants to be.
You knew Gary Shandling really well, but your first encounter with him was when you were in high school when you were 16, and you had a radio show in which you'd interview comics, and you'd somehow manage to get really great comics to talk to you, a high school kid on this tiny little high school radio station. How did you get Gary Shandling to talk with you?
Well, back then, there wasn't an internet, at least none that we knew about. And most comedians didn't do long format interviews. There were no podcasts, and other than maybe some morning radio to promote gigs. So I interviewed about 50 comedians, mainly by tricking their publicists into thinking that it wasn't a high school radio station, that it was just a normal radio station. And what I remember about the interview was he was just really funny and was very willing to talk about how jokes are written and then tell me a bunch of jokes to show me the process. And, you know, looking back, it's weird because he completely changed my life. He hired me to write for his show. He asked me to direct. I had never directed before. So it's weird that I knew him for so long. It almost feels predestined, our relationship, and then ultimately being able to tell, you know, the story of his life.
Gary Shandling came of age in comedy during the period when if you wanted to make it big, you had to do The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. It was the only late night show, and it was really like the only venue where you were going to get a national audience and people were going to hear your name. So in your documentary about Gary Shandling, you play a clip from Gary's first appearance on The Tonight Show. So I thought we should hear that clip.
I ate dinner last night at a friend of mine's house, and he has, what do you call those things? Baby. He has a baby. And I'm a single guy. I don't know how to relate to this too well, you know. And the baby's crawling around on the carpet, and this baby loads up his diaper, you know. And I'm sitting there, you know, and the mother comes over and says, "Isn't that adorable? Brandon made a gift for Daddy." Now, I'm figuring this guy's got to be real easy to shop for on Father's Day.
Okay, that was Gary Shandling's first Tonight Show performance. So, you know, it's funny. It's so not, like, anybody could have told that joke. You didn't need to be Gary Shandling to tell that. It's not a personal joke. It's not something that really comes out of his experience. So it's just interesting, since he became so personal as a comic, since he did two shows that were basically a comedy version of his life with him playing himself, it's such a really big journey that he took comedically.
I can only equate it to something like music. You know, the Beatles start out and they do "I Want to Hold Your Hand" or "Love Me Do," and then it turns into "Sgt. Pepper." And, you know, that joke is, you know, it's a solid joke. There's been so much comedy since then that it seems mild at this point. But Gary was a great joke writer, a great writer of one-liners and bits. And he evolved into something that was much deeper and more heartfelt. But like a lot of people, it starts out with something simpler.
So in talking about how Gary Shandling went from, you know, telling jokes that other comics could tell to doing stand-up that was much more personal, that's one of the things I asked him about when I interviewed him in December of 1992. And he was supposed to show up at a studio, but we got a call from his publicist saying that he had car trouble and that He couldn't make it, so we just did a phone interview. But anyways, I was talking to him here about like developing his voice in comedy. So let's hear a short excerpt of that. And I should mention, I'm honored to say you include an excerpt of this in the documentary version of your story about Gary Shandling's life. So thank you for including that.
Thank you.
So here's an excerpt.
When you started doing stand-up, did you have a sense of who you wanted to be on stage? You know, like what aspects of your own personality you really wanted to bring out for your stage persona?
It was really a nightmare. I had no idea who I was when I started, and I was frightened to death and had no natural performing skills. I'd never performed before in my life, and to be thrown onto the stand-up stage is an experience that you cannot fathom until you're actually there, because there's no place to go and everyone's looking at you and you can't even see them because of the lights, and yet you have to manage to start talking and be funny on top of it. And at the beginning, I think I did, I wrote material that was very much influenced by Woody Allen, who's my favorite, and I used to do very offbeat jokes that sounded like I was reading them. And it took years to develop a style. And actually what happened is I was involved in a relationship, and the girl left me, and I was very hurt, and I had to go up on stage, and I finally just turned to the audience and said, "This girl left me." I said, "What happened is she moved in with another guy." So I dumped her, because that's where I draw the line. And so that was the beginning. That was really the beginning of, you know, people of the Gary Shandling dating years in stand-up that came out, you know, because I realized, oh, I started to really spill my guts about being hurt, and people really related to it. And it just was one of those things. It was in a nightclub in Dallas. I really remember it very well.
You know, I think that's so interesting how uncomfortable he was on stage at the beginning, and how he felt like he sounded like he was reading his jokes.
And Mitzi Shore, who owned the Comedy Store, was very direct about the fact that she thought he was a terrible performer, and she didn't like writers who tried to do stand-up. So Gary, you know, couldn't really get in at the Comedy Store, and then he just started doing gigs at all these little crappy places in the Valley, and he didn't come back to the Comedy Store for a year, and then a year later he came back and he had found his voice and his confidence, and then they let him be a regular. But it is interesting that sometimes just one joke unlocks the key to your whole approach. You know, he had one joke that was very honest and based on his suffering. And then he realized, oh, this is the way. I go down this path.
You had to give a eulogy, and I assume you wanted to give a eulogy at his memorial service. And several comics, including Sarah Silverman, Kevin Nealon, gave eulogies. And you had to decide whether to be serious or funny. Tell us how you decided what tone you wanted to take, and then we'll hear what you had to say.
I, you know, sometimes you're just so grief-stricken that you don't even know how something got done. You don't know how you wrote a speech or put together a memorial, because you're just in a weird fever of sadness. I you know, I think we all felt that the best way to honor Gary would be to make a speech that was, you know, heartfelt and funny. Gary would want it to be funny. So I just tried to be sincere and do it in a way that I thought would make Gary laugh.
Okay, so here's Judd Apatow's eulogy at Gary Shandling's memorial.
It's been very emotional to go down the rabbit hole of Gary, but I feel like it's a lesson for me to just think very deeply about Gary's life and his death, and to learn from it. It's odd that Prince just died, because Gary and Prince were very similar. There really were no differences when you really get down to it. Gary was the prince of comedy. He was mysterious, complicated, sexually ambiguous. His talent was endless. He was a brilliant performer who may or not have been high the entire time. He had great hair. Both stood up against the man to get their back. And both were sexy as Larry Sanders' show was Gary's Purple Rain. It's Gary Shandling's show was his Dirty Mind. The only difference between the two men is that Gary had a huge That is the joke Gary would have wanted, and we know that.
And that's Judd Apatow eulogizing Gary Shandling, and that excerpt is included in the documentary that Judd Apatow made about Gary Shandling, The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling. So, I can hear you tearing up at the same time you're trying to, say some funny things about Gary. Was it hard to hold it together while you were doing that?
Oh, I didn't hold it together. I just had to get through it. You know, Gary had so many friends. There were 1,000 people at his memorial service. It was really a beautiful event. And I made a few documentary pieces that were about 5 minutes long, showing moments from his life and interviews with Gary. And that's what made me want to do the documentary, because in just preparing those, I realized that there was a story that people would like to hear and an inspiration in his life. And I think Gary wanted to try to find a way to figure out how to tell people about everything that's in the book and in the documentary, and he hadn't figured it out yet. So to me, a lot of this work is, completing something that Gary had started.
Judd Apatow, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Judd Apatow's new book is called It's Gary Shandling's Book.